Born Bertha Wernham in Kirkcaldy in the Kingdom of Fife, she tells me. It's not a shire, Scotland. She has become the first lady member of the 9 members of the Supreme Court of Canada. She's a native of Aberdeen, a graduate of the University of Aberdeen. They do it the right way. They give the MA right off the bat. She met her husband, John, while John was doing his divinity degree at Aberdeen. They married, and John received his first call to a Presbyterian parish at Macduff in Banffshire. Now, I'll have to introduce both Reverend Wilson and Madam Justice, as her career was initially dependent upon his career. They spent 4 years at Macduff. Grand name, I would have thought. I asked John, who I've known a long time, how big the parish was. He said, well, it was 50-50 farming and fishing, about all 1,000 souls, some of them very odd. Actually, he said 1,000 odd, then he said some of them very odd. The Reverend John next received a call to a parish in Canada, in the Ottawa Valley, at Renfrew, Ontario. They then accepted that call and emigrated. That was in 1949. The next change occurred when the Royal Canadian Navy, as we were then and may shortly be able to call it again, wished to balance the religious mix in its chaplaincy. The Presbyterian Church of Canada asked the Reverend John to accept a call to the Canadian destroyer fleet at sea off Korea, which he accepted, so that in 1952 he joined the RCN chaplain service and went to sea in Korea. When he returned, he and Madam Justice now went first to Cornwallis in the Annapolis Valley in Nova Scotia, and later to HMCS Stadacona in Halifax. Now, they moved to a house which was situated across the street from the campus of Dalhousie in Halifax. She could apparently see the law school from her living room. John went off to naval duties. Now, when I was talking to our guest, I asked her, as I sort of had a hint of it, you're not telling me that you only went to law school because it was across the street. Well, she hesitated a moment and said yes. In the fall of 1954, after the kind of conversations you can imagine which would take place between a graduate in MA and the then dean, Horace Emerson Reed, joined the class of Dalhousie, assembling in 1954 in the fall, which became ultimately the class of 57. It had two interesting characteristics. It was the largest class in peacetime in the history of Dalhousie, which you must understand celebrated its first 100 years last year. And it also had the largest group of ladies in the history of any class to that time, which was numbered 5. Now, I can tell you that our guest was the star of her class. I can say that as I was a member of that class. But I hasten to say that I had absolutely nothing to do with asking you to come here tonight to speak. That pleasant chore, fell again to Mrs. Nemetz. She finished, did extremely well, of course, in the class, articled with a very distinguished and interesting character called Fred Bissett, later Mr. Justice. She was called to the Nova Scotia Bar. John retired from the Navy. They then transferred with the support of his church to the administrative staff of the United Church in Toronto. But from there, our guest began her own career. She articled at Osler, Hoskins, and Harcourt, was called to the Ontario Bar in 1959. Osler, Hoskins, as lawyers will know, is a very distinguished and now large firm, perhaps with a national, maybe an international reputation. It was of the order of about 40 when our guest joined in 1958 and is now about 120. She was sworn in as the first lady member of the Ontario Court of Appeal in 1975, as most of you will know, that was 16 years later. She allowed in her speech of acceptance that it was the first time, apart from her appearances to be called in Nova Scotia and Ontario, when she had gone to appear in a courtroom. She had never appeared in the courtroom to that time, either on behalf of a client or to argue a case, prior to her being sworn. She did, of course, extremely well. 7 years later, she was promoted to the Supreme Court of Canada as one of the three members of the Ontario Bar who sit on that court. Now, save and except for our own Court of Appeal, Chief Justice, the Ontario Court of Appeal is an extremely distinguished and very influential body in the growth and development of law in Canada. So I ask you to accept from me that this lady's promotion to that court and from that court to the Supreme Court of Canada had virtually nothing to do with her sex. Lady judges are now, and by the time of her promotion, not uncommon. We know that we have a Chief Justice of a trial division in Nova Scotia, who's a lady. We have a Chief Justice Connie Glooby, who was 2 years ahead of us, if I may say. We have a member of the Court of Appeal in Quebec. There's a growing number on the trial courts of Canada, both the Section 96 courts and the provincial courts. But the interesting thing is the phenomena of the wave of lady lawyers immediately behind us. I'm of 53 or 4 years of age, and I can tell you that I meet these ladies on a daily basis, and they're intimidatingly competent. 43%, I'm told by Dean Peter Burns, of the current UBC Law School are ladies. The change that's going to be wrought to the law, one shudders to think about. Chief, would you join me in that shudder? Our guest appears before us in the character of a distinguished Canadian jurist of 9 years seniority who has earned her professional fame by her own efforts. I ask you to welcome her, and I will ask her to speak to the topic, the children, casualties of a failed marriage. Madam Justice Bertha Wilson.
Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, it is indeed a pleasure and privilege to be invited to join the distinguished group of speakers who have delivered lectures to this institute. I am very happy to be with you this evening and appreciate very much that the invitation from Mrs. Bell Nemetz prompted Dean Peter Burns to ask me to be for a few days resident judge at the law school. It has been for me an exciting experience, not only to dialogue with the students and the teaching staff, but also to have been the guest of the bench and bar, and through these experiences to have absorbed something of the legal ethos in British Columbia. This evening is the climax of my visit to Vancouver and offers me now the honor and the opportunity of meeting with and speaking to a larger public. I have therefore chosen as my subject a topic which I believe should, in this day of very rapid change, be of real concern to all of us, namely, children, the casualties of a failed marriage. In 1921, According to a recent study by Statistics Canada, there were 6.4 divorces in this country per 100,000 population. By 1961, the number of divorces per 100,000 persons had increased to 51.2. That rate remained relatively constant until the passage of the present Divorce Act in 1968, when the legal grounds for the dissolution of marriage were greatly expanded. In the following year, the divorce rate more than doubled, and by 1978, it had nearly doubled again. That represents a rate of divorce approximately five times higher than the rate in 1961 and about 38 times higher than the rate in 1921. The number of divorces has continued to escalate since 1978, although I noticed with interest in the papers last week that the statistics showed a slight decline for the first time since 1971. Now, since almost half of divorcing couples have dependent children, it's evident that the number of children who currently come from broken homes is a social phenomenon without precedent. Given the implications of that fact for both the legal system and the Canadian community as a whole, and since the amendments to the Divorce Act tabled before the last Parliament would have made the dissolution of marriage even easier than it is at present, the time seems to be right for a review of the historical development and the present trends in the law of child custody. A word then about the historical developments. The natural starting point for any such discussion is the principle, now generally recognized as fundamental, that in deciding issues of custody, the court should always look to what would be in the best interests of the child concerned. Although it's only in this century that that principle has won nearly universal legislative and judicial acceptance, it's not a recent innovation in the law. By means of a probably fictional delegation to the courts of equity of the prerogatives of the sovereign as parens patriae or parent of the state, those courts have had since at least the middle of the 17th century an inherent jurisdiction to protect the rights of anyone under a legal disability, and that of course includes children. The power of a court of equity to intervene between parent and child, where the welfare of the child demanded it, was in theory of very broad scope. But during the 18th and 19th centuries, it was exercised rather sparingly. By the common law of England, a father had a near absolute right to the custody of his children. This right, which amounted almost to a property right, could be maintained not only against third parties, but against the child's mother as well. It applied even in the case of nursing infants. A father was entitled to administer reasonable corporal punishment, and he alone had the right to decide how his children would be brought up and educated. Indeed, Blackstone was of the view that a father was the guardian of his child by nature, and that a mother was entitled to no power but only reverence and respect. As the 19th century progressed, the attitude of English society and of the judiciary gradually began to change. The view developed that the welfare of the child must be the foremost consideration, and that equity should never hesitate to deny a father his right at common law if to do so would be in the child's best interests. And by the end of the century, statutory enactments began to reflect these changing attitudes. As the welfare of the child came to be regarded as paramount, the balance of parental rights, which had favored the father to the almost absolute exclusion of the mother, was necessarily eroded as well. It was not until the first quarter of this century, however, when the Guardianship of Infants Act of 1925 was passed, that the English Parliament finally gave full statutory effect to the principle that in any proceeding involving the custody and upbringing of children, the court shall regard the welfare of the infant as the first and paramount consideration. It was that statute also which first established complete theoretical equality between mother and father in matters of child custody. As Professor Constance Backhouse has shown in an interesting recent study, the evolution of custody law in Canada reflected developments in England. Generally speaking, however, Canadian courts tended to be conservative in outlook, and it was left to the legislatures to bring about changes in the law of custody. During the first half of the 20th century, the law throughout Canada with respect to custody disputes became more or less standardized. Even where the relevant legislation did not expressly provide as much, the test the judiciary applied was what is in the best interests of the child. Gradually it became accepted, at least in disputes between natural parents, between the mother and father, that the best interests criterion was not simply the paramount consideration in custody cases, it was the sole consideration. It's not altogether surprising, however, that while they were prepared to adopt this approach in custody contests between natural parents, the father and the mother, the courts were not quite so sure when the contest for custody was between a natural parent and someone else. A 1970 decision of the House of Lords in England was the first case in which foster parents were able to win custody over biological parents. And it was only in 1973 that a similar decision was reached in Canada by the Ontario Court of Appeal. In the English case, Lord Guest stated that the best interests principle that had been enacted in the Guardianship of Infants Act in 1925 was of universal application and was not limited to contests between parents. With the exception of legislation in the areas of adoption and the taking of children into public care, this position is now generally accepted throughout the common law world. This is not to say that so-called blood ties are without importance in custody decisions, but only that they too are subservient to the cardinal principle of the child's best interests. Now, this brief historical sketch shows that the present state of Canadian law on the custody of children does not represent a sharp break with the past. It has its roots in an equitable doctrine several centuries old, and its development has been the result of a gradual evolution, both judicial and legislative in nature, that has taken place over the last 150 years. It would be my submission that that evolution has far from ended, although its focus, I believe, has shifted. Its focus today is less on the substantive aspects of custody law, the legal principles that dictate the result, and more on its institutional or procedural aspects. For we recognize now that the manner in which decisions on child custody are reached can have dramatic repercussions for the well-being of a child, either directly or through its effect on those engaged in the custody battle. It's come home to us, in other words, that in order to give effect to the best interests doctrine in its widest sense, the courts must ensure not only that the proper substantive principles are applied in the process of decision-making as to who is to have custody, but the process of decision-making itself must be conducted in such a way as to minimize detrimental consequences for the child. And I want to return to that theme later. But first, let me outline briefly the constitutional position with respect to custody in Canada, and then identify some of the insights the behavioral sciences have provided into the effects of marriage breakdown on the children of the marriage. First, the constitutional position. The Constitution Act of 1867 gives the Federal Parliament exclusive legislative jurisdiction over marriage and divorce. The provinces have jurisdiction over property and civil rights in the province. And this has been held to include jurisdiction over the custody of children. The present Federal Divorce Act provides that, and I'm quoting from it, upon granting a decree nisi of divorce, the court may, if it thinks fit and just to do so, having regard to the conduct of the parties and the condition, means, and other circumstances of each of them, make an order providing for the custody, care, and upbringing of children of the marriage. Now, it will be noted that this provision makes no express mention of the best interests of the children, and in fact appears to make the conduct of the parties a significant factor in the custody decision. Whether that conduct affects the children's well-being or not. As I have already mentioned, however, the courts have tended to apply the best interests test regardless, and have come to take account of a marriage partner's conduct only to the extent that it might affect his or her capacity to be a good parent. Bill C-10, which was before the last session of Parliament to amend the Divorce Act, would have deleted the reference to parental conduct altogether. Various provincial statutes authorize the making of custody and access orders in circumstances where there is no divorce. Almost every province has made the child's best interests the sole or paramount criterion in these decisions. A number of provinces have gone further and have specified in some detail what is meant by the best interests of the child. A good example is Section 24 of the British Columbia Family Relations Act, which provides that in assessing these interests, the court is to have regard to the following factors. A, the health and emotional well-being of the child, including any special needs for care and treatment. B, where appropriate, the views of the child. C, the love, affection, and similar ties that exist between the child and other persons. D, education and training for the child. And E, the capacity of each person to whom guardianship, custody, or access rights and duties may be granted to exercise these rights and duties adequately. The British Columbia Act also expressly provides that the conduct of a person is irrelevant except where it substantially affects one or more of these factors, and then only to the extent of the affection. Now, the emphasis in the British Columbia statute and also in a comparable statute in Ontario on the child's emotional ties is an acknowledgement of the importance which the behavioral sciences now attach to the concept of psychological parenthood. This notion, which was first given prominence by Joseph Goldstein, Anna Freud, and Albert Solnit in a very well-known book called Beyond the Best Interests of the Child, is explained this way by the authors. unlike adults, children have no psychological conception of relationship by blood tie until quite late in their development. What registers in their minds are the day-to-day interchanges with the adults who take care of them, and who, on the strength of these, become the parent figures to whom they are attached. The child's emotional attachment results from day-to-day attention to his needs for physical care, nourishment, comfort, affection, and stimulation. Only a parent who provides for these needs will be able to build a psychological relationship to the child on the basis of the biological one. Goldstein, Freud, and Solnit emphasize that there is a need for continuity of relationships in a child's life if psychological parenthood is to develop unimpeded. This consideration is in fact made explicit in the Ontario Children's Law Reform Act, which directs the judge to take account of the length of time that the child has lived in a stable home environment. Goldstein, Freud, and Solnit remark that the consequences of a disruption in continuity will vary with the age of the child. In the case of infants, for example, interruption of the relationship with the person who cares for them can affect their emotional development. The children tend to become less trustful. And if the continuity of attachments is broken more than once, their emotional attachments may become, in the author's words, increasingly shallow and indiscriminate. For children still under the age of 5, disruptions in continuity can interfere with such achievements as toilet training and the ability to speak. In the case of school-age children, losing contact with their psychological parent can lead to antisocial behavior and delinquency. Now, the legislation in both Ontario and British Columbia permits a court to consider the wishes of the child in determining the order that would be in his or her best interests. The Law Reform Commission of Canada's report on family law recommended that Parliament should provide that the wishes of a child should be taken into account to the extent the court considers appropriate, having regard to the age and maturity of the child. It's rather interesting that this recommendation was not incorporated into Bill C-10. If two parents are separated or divorced, and one of them is awarded sole custody of their child, the question arises whether the non-custodial parent should be permitted access to the child. The approach that courts in Canada have tended to take is that a parent will not be denied access unless there is a clear indication that to grant it would be harmful to the child. This seems to be premised on the assumption that access is a right of the parent, whereas opinion seems to be moving today in the direction that access is a right of the child. But whether access is characterized as a right of the parent or a right of the child, the rationale for a grant of access seems to be, in the words of Mr. Justice Galligan of the Ontario Divisional Court, and I quote him, a reasonable philosophical presumption or a natural human feeling that a child will benefit from continued connection with each parent. The authors of the book I referred to earlier, Beyond the Best Interests of the Child, question the soundness of this presumption. They put forward the rather radical proposal that the custodial parent and not the courts should decide whether or not access is to be granted to the other parent. The rationale is the need to preserve continuity in the child's life and to protect the psychological bond between the child and the custodial parent. While they would still permit access at the custodial parent's discretion, it's clear that they regard continued contact with the non-custodial parent as potentially more harmful to the child than beneficial. Whatever may be the other merits of Beyond the Best Interests of the Child, the general professional consensus that seems to have developed is that the authors are wrong on this point, and that ordinarily it is in the best interests of the child to maintain an ongoing relationship with both parents. Now, there may be better methods of ensuring that a child maintains contact with both parents than granting sole custody to one parent and access to the other. Custody, which ordinarily carries with it the exclusive right to direct a child's education and upbringing, is awarded in the great majority of cases to the mother. As Mel Roman and William Haddad point out in their book, The Disposable Parent, this is something of an ironic reversal of the father's near absolute right to custody at common law. They also make the point that such an arrangement tends to place too much responsibility on one parent and too little on the other, to the detriment of the child in both cases. The obvious solution to this problem would seem to be to divide custodial responsibility more evenly between the two parents. And there are a number of ways in which this can be done. A split custody order, which has been commonly in use in England for some time, entrusts one parent with the physical care and control of the child while giving the other parent legal custody, a role in the major decision-making concerning the child. An alternating or divided custody order gives to each parent in turn full custody, including physical care and control, for specified alternating periods of time. An order of joint or shared custody awards full legal custody to both parents together, so that major decisions affecting the child's welfare and upbringing will be taken by them both. One parent assumes physical care and control of the child, while the other has liberal access, or else both parents alternate in having care and control for specified periods of time. It's becoming more and more common for separating parents to agree to some form of joint custody for their children. In light of various clinical studies which have been done, such consensual arrangements would clearly seem to be in the child's best interest. The question, however, which then comes naturally to mind, is whether it can ever be in a child's best interests for a court to order joint custody in an adversarial proceeding in which such an order has not been sought by the parties. The Ontario Court of Appeal has answered no to that question in two important cases, expressing the view that by its very nature, joint custody is not an arrangement which can be imposed on people by a court. In the second of those two cases, Kruger versus Kruger, I dissented on the ground that the findings of fact at trial seem to indicate that both parties were equally fine parents and quite capable of cooperating in the upbringing of their children. Whatever view one may take of that particular issue, no one will disagree that consensual solutions to custody disputes are preferable to court-imposed solutions. Not only is consensus more likely to lead to productive results than coercion, but the privacy and dignity of everyone involved, including the child, is respected to the greatest extent possible by a consensual arrangement. I might add in passing that one of the principles which motivated Goldstein, Freud, and Solnit to propose that decisions concerning access should be made by the custodial parent alone was the desire to protect these very values of privacy and dignity by keeping the role of the state in custody matters to an absolute minimum. That aim is without doubt a commendable one. But as a number of commentators have pointed out, the proposed solution would in all probability have the opposite effect. With so much at stake, parents would be more rather than less likely to litigate the custody of their children. How then can our legal system encourage separated or divorced parents to cooperate in the upbringing of their children? To find an answer to this, I come back to the institutional or procedural aspect of the best interests doctrine, which I referred to earlier. The characteristic of our legal system, which presents the greatest obstacle to consensual solutions to custody disputes, is its adversarial nature. The underlying justification for the adversarial approach to the settlement of lawsuits is founded on the expectation that both the facts and the correct answer in law are most likely to emerge when both sides present their respective points of view in a totally partisan fashion before an impartial and non-participating arbiter. 1966 decision of Mr. Justice Manning of the Supreme Court of Alberta, in which he suggested that the interests of children who were involved in a particularly bitter divorce proceeding should be represented by counsel acting as amicus curiae or friend of the court. Since then, an informal institution of amicus curiae for the independent representation of children has developed and flourished in Alberta, operating without any legislative mandate but funded by the Attorney General's office. Since the very informality of this arrangement has won approval because of the flexibility it permits, there does not appear to have been any perceived need to replace the present system by one of a more formal character. The power to appoint amicus curiae in this way derives, in the absence of direct legislative authority, from the court's inherent parens patriae jurisdiction, which I mentioned earlier. The parens patriae power has also been relied on in Ontario to justify the appointment of independent counsel for children in custody disputes. And in a recent adoption case that came before us in the Supreme Court of Canada, Re Bisson, we similarly relied on that power in ordering separate legal representation for the child concerned. Now, there is a problem about a lawyer acting as counsel for the child. It's sometimes been said that he who acts on behalf of the child should represent the child's best interests rather than the child himself. As a number of writers have pointed out, however, that would be to anticipate the function of the judge. It would also involve a premature assessment of what the child's best interests are, since the lawyer would presumably not yet have heard all the relevant evidence. Judge Abella has recommended that a lawyer who is representing a child should put forward the child's wishes, and in cases where those wishes cannot be ascertained, that the lawyer generally should assist the court in ensuring that all relevant information is before it. And this seems to be how at least some commentators view the amicus curiae program that exists in Alberta. Another technique that's gaining currency for determining not only the child's wishes, but also what would be best for the child generally, is an independent assessment by a psychiatrist or a social worker. Such an assessment is even more useful to the court if it extends to the whole family and not just to the child. A comprehensive report, which has been prepared by a neutral professional, is likely to be of much greater value to the court than partisan and probably incomplete expert testimony which is given on behalf of one side or the other. In Ontario, the courts have been making a practice for some time of encouraging the parties in custody actions to agree to voluntary consent orders that call for psychiatric examinations of both children and parents. In Alberta, a child's amicus curiae will often instruct a social worker to conduct a home study or have psychiatrists or psychologists interview the parties and sometimes the child. And in a number of provinces, including British Columbia and Ontario, there is now legislation giving the courts the authority to order independent investigations of this kind. This type of modification to the adversary system might seem to bear an uncomfortable resemblance to an inquisitorial model, but I think that such a view is mistaken. The court does not itself conduct the investigation, and it is free to reject any recommendation which the experts put forward. The impartiality of the court, therefore, is in no way called into question. There's one other institutional aspect of the best interest doctrine which does not really bear at all on the adversary nature of the legal system, but which calls for comment nonetheless. That is the element of delay, which has become such an unfortunate but endemic fact of life in our courts. In a 1971 study of the attitude of Ontario judges to the workings of custody laws, Adrian Bradbrook found a marked reluctance on the part of judges to change the de facto possession of a child where the pre-trial arrangement had been in existence for longer than 6 months. As we have seen, there is a sound basis in psychological theory for this unwillingness to disrupt the continuity in a child's life. It nonetheless has the effect of encouraging parties to do whatever they can to obtain possession of the child before the proceedings begin. Furthermore, while it may be in the child's best interests at the time of trial to order that de facto possession remain undisturbed, it is clearly not in the child's best interest, in a wider sense, to permit delays which restrict the court's options so considerably. For the same reason, appeals should be heard only rarely in custody cases, and then always on an expedited basis. All too often, by the time a case actually comes to be heard, in the higher courts particularly, it has already been effectively decided by the passage of time. I would like to conclude, because I'm sure there are many lawyers present in the audience tonight, by posing a question which is of great concern to judges. What is the role of counsel advising a client in a custody dispute under this new modality? Does he or she continue to fuel the fires of the adversary process as if a custody fight was just a fight like any other? Or is a totally different approach required? Is counsel an integral part of the new institutional framework for deciding custody issues? How do we as lawyers respond to new social arrangements for the dramatically escalating numbers of children from broken homes? Is a 1960s style counsel an anachronism in the 1980s? Child custody is no longer a private matter. It's one that affects the whole community. For what is in the best interests of our children is most surely in the best interests of us all. Thank you very much.
I've explained to Madam Justice Wilson that we claim it as a perk to ask questions. She has agreed to answer any questions, so that there are questions. Yes? Thank you. I'll repeat the question. I'm told I was very good last week. I don't know about this week. The range of interests which affect issues that touch custody, particularly in the privacy of a parental situation, can vary from a hippie situation to a traditional and classic family expectation in terms of child rearing. You talk about the phrase in the case, which we accept as being the law, which is the best interest of the child. What's the judicial perspective?
Well, that's obviously a very hard question to answer, but I think what we can say is that today a very wide range of different lifestyles are now generally found to be acceptable. This was probably not always so. Traditionally, there probably was a kind of well-defined, generally accepted concept of what was a reasonable kind of lifestyle, what was a reasonable kind of environment for a child to be brought up in. And indeed, one of the criticisms I think that is sometimes made of the judiciary is that they might tend to impose their concept of what would be an acceptable form of environment for a child to be reared in. Now, happily, I think that the traditional narrowness, if you like, in viewing what would be a proper kind of environment for raising children is much more flexible, much more relaxed. I think this is one of the interesting things about the last 20 or 30 years, is that people are now doing their own thing. It's accepted now that people will do their own thing. People are living in very, very different, all kinds of different forms of lifestyles. And I would hope that when we apply this best interests doctrine, that that would be something that we would take into consideration. And indeed, from my experience as a judge, I would say that that is being taken into consideration now far more than it used to.
Is the issue of the property, finances, I guess resources of the family, a factor in the judicial consideration of what's in the best interests of the child? I guess an aspect of the first question I should put was, and I think you've dealt with it, that we've grown used to thinking of the judiciary being relatively conservative in their approach to this type of a modern problem. And there's an aspect of that in this question, too, as I read it.
Yes, I think one of the recent developments in family law, and obviously an excellent development that's taken place in recent years, is the concept of the unified family court, the concept that you can go to one court to have decided all the issues, all the contentious issues concerning the family when the marriage breaks down. Divorce, division of property and ownership of assets, and custody of children. Because clearly, if custody of children is given to one parent, the court must ensure that that parent has the financial resources to give the care and upbringing to the child that is contemplated. So it's been recognized that the previous system, whereby these various aspects of a broken marriage might be dealt with in separate courts by different judges, it's been recognized that this is clearly undesirable, and we've now moved towards this concept of the unified family court, where all matters pertaining to the family when it breaks down are dealt with together. And of course, something like the possession or ownership of the family home, the court's decision as to custody or the agreement of the parties as to custody will obviously be very relevant with respect to who should have the family home. Similarly, the monetary payments that may be required to be made by one spouse to the other, particularly if that other has been given the responsibility for custody. That will have to take into consideration again the responsibilities that have been assumed by the parent who has accepted and been given responsibility for the child. So this is, as I say, one of the exciting developments that have happened is this lumping together and dealing with, once and for all the aspects that arise when a family relationship disintegrates.
Sir? Just a moment. There's a gentleman behind you, and I'll come back to you in a moment. Please. Considering the significance of the statistical information, which indicates that the laws were both intended and did in fact make divorce easier to achieve, particularly in 1968, is it your judgment, bearing in mind the percentage of divorces which have dependent children at stake, would you make the law more difficult in respect of the ease of getting divorced or leave it as it is?
Well, it's difficult for me to express a personal opinion on that. I guess, as with all laws, as with all legislation, and as with judicial decision-making as well, there really develops a consensus of some sort in the community, which in turn conditions, I suppose, what legislatures and to some extent what judges do. And I think it would be my perception that the public generally appear to favor making divorce easier. I think that if you're going to do that, you should probably make marriage more difficult. But it seems to me that is the direction we're moving, and indeed the bill that was before the last Parliament would have introduced no-fault divorce. So I think unquestionably we're moving that way. It was rejected simply because Parliament dissolved, so it's off the order paper.
But more than the order paper has changed, I understand. Sir?
For many years I've worried or wondered whether the court is the best agency or arena in which the child abuse problems are settled. It seems to me more a medical problem than a legal one, and yet the assignment of blame
bearing in mind the administrative changes you've outlined in respect of the improvement of devices available to the court to deal with dependent children in marriage breakup, have you any views in respect of the facilities available to the court to deal with the other aspects of child risk, such as abuse and cruelty?
I'm inclined to agree that the courts are probably not the best institutions to deal with child abuse. I think more and more we are coming to realize that child abuse may be largely a medical problem. And as you know, it's very difficult for the court to think in terms of punishment for something that the person perhaps can't help. So it may be that the court is not the best institution to deal with that, but at the moment it seems to be the best we've got.
There was as well a question about whether or not there were medical aspects that might make it more meritorious to move it from courts.
Well, I agree. I think that's absolutely right. I mean, at the present time, I suppose the best the courts can do is have expert medical testimony and so on. But I tend to think that ultimately that's something that we want to be dealing with. That's just my own personal view.
I think we have time for two more questions. Mrs. Nemetz. The question of the dependent child being supported financially in the circumstances where the mother has the care and the father has the responsibility to contribute, what, in terms of effectiveness, do you see of the devices available to courts to attempt to render balanced situations out of imbalanced situations there?
Well, I agree that one of the real problems that we face today is the inability to enforce maintenance payments that have been ordered by the court, usually to be made by the husband. And there are, I've forgotten the figures now, but they're quite astronomical as to the number of these orders made by Canadian courts that are simply ignored because the husband has left the jurisdiction, cannot be located. There have been one or two interesting cases recently as to what can be done to try to track down some of these husbands who are not honoring their obligations in terms of attempting to get information as to where they might be from various sources. And there are always problems arise in that connection because in many cases the bodies of persons asked to disclose that information are concerned that they don't have the right to do so. So there is a tremendous problem to which, as far as I know, we currently have no answer as to how to make these husbands, usually it is, against whom these orders are outstanding, pay. I would hope that this would be something that the legislatures, both the federal legislature and the provincial legislatures, would get together on and try to come up with some kind of a solution.
One more question. Yes? That's a neat question. Can the child, in a circumstance in which he is in the custody of a parent where he's not happy, initiate a change of his own volition, I take it?
Well, obviously, now we have to be concerned about the age of this child. If you're talking about, you know, a teenager or older child, presumably he can take some steps. In particular, he can contact the parent, the non-custodial parent. And custody of children is one of the types of issues that is always open before the court. Lawyers tend to say custody order is never final, because either parent can always approach the court to have the order changed. This makes a lot of sense because, as you point out, conditions can change, and the environment in which the court has ordered the child to be may no longer be a desirable environment. But the legislation keeps custody orders open-ended so that at any time they can be examined again, the new conditions, the changed conditions established, and the order can be changed. It would require, and if it was being done at the instigation of the child, that the child make contact with the non-custodial parent, because that parent would be the person to start the proceedings to have the custody order re-examined by the court in light of the changed conditions.
Before I ask Chief Justice Nemetz to thank our speaker, I should remind you that we have next week a man considered by many to be the world's foremost authority on Byzantine history, Professor Alexander Kazdan, and I invite you to be here Saturday, the 29th of September at 8:15 to hear him. Chief Justice Nemetz.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, in opening comments, Mr. Vogel said to you that this judge had been appointed solely on merit. I think on hearing her scholarly address, you will all agree that it was an appointment made solely on merit. However, it also happens to be that this judge is a woman, and the first woman to have reached the Supreme Court of Canada in that position for almost 120 years since the inception of our federation. When I was first at practice, there were no women in any of the high courts of this country. There are now a growing number of such women. Their influence, and as you heard tonight, the influence of one especially in the particularly high position Madam Justice Wilson is in, will influence our law greatly in the direction of progressive and intelligent, civilized behavior, I hope, in the interest of children, and therefore in the interest of society as a whole. For those of you who play Trivial Pursuit, I might add just an added bit of information. When the question first arose as to what to call a woman who was appointed to the bench, the question in Canada was decided in favor of Madam Justice. In England, it wasn't so. They decided on Mrs. Justice. When the matter was put, I understand, to the present woman occupant of the United States Supreme Court, and she chose to reject both. She said, just Justice O'Connor will do. On your behalf, I should like to thank our speaker, not only for the splendid address that she gave tonight, but also for the hectic week that she's put on these 6 days in which she's spoken to lawyers, to students, to judges, and out of the Vancouver Institute. On your behalf, I thank her.
On that happy note, I move the meeting adjourned.